Okay, so tonight I will be talking about amphibian parasites, which is a pretty cool topic. The lecture outline, I'm going to overview different types of amphibian parasites, current information on the mechanisms and effects of each type of parasite, evidence of the effect of chytrid fungus on parasite infection in amphibians, which was kind of a side note, but I thought it was interesting, and future directions for research concerning amphibian parasites. So what is a parasite? Go back to freshman biology. Hook me up. Or it could kill it. Okay, so a parasite is a plant or animal that lives on or inside another living organism, and it's dependent on its host and obtains some kind of benefit. It differs from each parasite. So let's see here. Okay, what are some amphibian parasites that you've heard about? Or have you heard about any amphibian parasites? What? Ooh, I didn't cover that one. So yeah, and kind of, yeah, sure. So any other ones that we've heard about? Yay, worms, yes, excellent. Yes, leech, good job, guy. What? Ticks, yeah. Yeah, mites, ticks, all that good stuff. So let's see what I got here. Metazoans, protozoans, endoparasitic mites, and then there's ectoparasites, which are the leeches. Some protozoan parasites live symbiotically, so they don't really harm their host, but all the ones that I'm covering do some kind of damage, or they are thought to do some kind of damage. And amphibian parasites are kind of cool. You can find them anywhere, pretty much on or inside the body. Like some go through the eye, some go through the rectum, or they just hang on for dear life. So the first one we're going to talk about is Ribeiroria odontae, which I may not have said that right, but anyways. In this study, Pacific tree frogs were exposed to varying amounts of Ribeiroria cerceriae. And these different amounts were ones that were traditionally seen in the wild. So they try to make it as close to natural populations as possible. Malformations were found in 85% of frogs that actually survived to metamorphosis. So let's see here. Frequency of abnormalities was positively correlated with parasite density, which you can see in this drawing over here. We have the trematode density on the x-axis and the frequency of the trematode on the y-axis. And as you can see, as trematode density goes up, the abnormalities also go up and survival goes way down. Let's see here. Severe abnormalities also increase the parasite density. So the more parasites there were, the more severe the malformations were. Like at lower concentrations, malformations may just be, you know, without the foot but still have most of the leg. And with higher densities, the whole leg would be missing or both legs would be missing. Few abnormal adult frogs were seen in the study, which they kind of thought was had to do with indirect mortality because they were had higher predation rates because they couldn't obviously hop and run away from predators. And interestingly enough, only 40% of the heaviest treatment, which was the 106, or excuse me, the 48, only 40% of those actually survived to metamorphosis, and they all had malformations, all 100% of them. And all abnormalities seen in this study were in the hind limbs only. There was none in the forelimbs. So here's a little bit of information about the trematode itself, and there's its life cycle you can see. And the cerceriae of Ribeiroria encyst around the limb buds. Side effects from this trematode are malformations including multiple extra limbs, skin webbings, bony triangles, and missing or partially missing limbs. And an important note, to actually have malformations, the Ribeiroria must encyst during the window of early limb development. If the Ribeiroria encysts after the limbs have developed, they're very unlikely to develop malformations after that point. And there's two hypotheses to explain the mechanism leading to limb malformations because of this trematode. It's not really known exactly what causes it, but this is kind of what they've come up with. There's a mechanical effect. So the parasite actually encysting itself in the limb bud disturbs the arrangement of growing limb cells, leading to abnormal limb formation. Or there could be some kind of chemical effect. Maybe the trematode produces a compound or just inhibits the limb growth that way. And also, I was going to ask you guys that. Okay, so there's also additional stressors that in combination with this trematode that may increase the frequency of malformations. So if the frog is under additional stress, like maybe under pesticide exposure, that can reduce their immunity, or predation by fish or any other animal, they may reduce their activity, therefore increasing the risk of being exposed to the trematode. So now we're going to move into the nematode. And larvae penetrate the skin, and then they migrate to the lungs. So there's a little drawing down here that kind of shows you how that happens. And they actually are excreted in the feces, and then they grow in the soil, and then they climb up, like when the frog is walking around, they climb up on the frog and like walk up it, well not walk, but go up through it in its mouth and get in its lungs that way. It's kind of cool. In this study, 80 toads were exposed and infected with various amounts of nematodes. And again, this is to simulate situations that you would find in the wild, so that's where they got those numbers. And the abundance of nematodes decreased over time naturally, which will become important in just a minute. And toads were fed increasing amounts of crickets. So initially they were fed 0.1 grams, and by the end of the study they were fed 0.3 grams. So their food was actually increased as the parasite was doing its thing. So now I have some graphs for you, and I want you guys to check these out and see if you can figure out what's going on. I'll give you a minute to look at them. On this one, the weeks post-infection, the parasites were introduced here, and then this is weeks after that, versus the host weight. So there's the control, so it grew without any problems on that one. And on this one, here's survival. All the control lived, none of them died. And I don't know if you can see these numbers or not, so I'll help you out there. This is 10 parasites, 40, 80, and 160. So you can see weeks post-infection, 12 weeks after they were introduced, the proportion of hosts surviving with the highest parasite was pretty low. And then proportion of cricket biomass eaten. So like I said, they were giving them more and more crickets over the study. And you can see what's going on with that one. So what does all this mean? It's really, go for it.
I'm not going to ask or tell you what it means.
Oh.
I'm just going to ask that one interesting thing that I see for survival. Why is the 40 doing just fine, same as control, until 10?
Well, that's a fabulous question, actually. You know?
And if the 10 is gradually going down, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I could probably say is that even though they were exposed to 40, a lot of times not all 40 were found at the end of the study when they killed them. So it may have been that, you know, only 10 actually made it to the lungs, perhaps. So, yeah, that's the only thing I know for that one.
Maybe less competition between the nematodes themselves.
Right, yeah. So, let's see here. So basically, to sum all this up, toads with different amounts of infection had different patterns of growth, which is pretty, makes a lot of sense. Let's see, mortality was correlated with worm density, but like I said, some of them didn't actually end up with as many parasites as they had to begin with. And toads ate progressively smaller amounts, even though they were fed higher amounts, led to them having a parasite-induced anorexia, which may allow the toads to wait out infection, because the parasites do eventually are passed on through their feces. So if they can just hold out long enough to let these parasites do their thing and get through, then hopefully their survival rates will be higher, and that will decrease their chances of further infection. Or the parasite-induced anorexia may result from interference with activity behaviors, because the parasites are in their lungs interfering with, you know, that's bringing them down and decreasing their foraging behaviors. Smaller toads were initially more susceptible to mortality, especially those introduced to higher numbers of parasites, which is kind of like what I was saying in the previous study. It seems like maybe, you know, with the limb buds, they're more susceptible. Yeah, Megan?
Can you finish your...
No, it's fine. Go ahead. I'm good. Right.
The chances of reinfection. I mean, so what would be the point of going into that anorexic state if you're just going to get reinfected?
Right. So the thing is if they're passing these out through their feces, what is the chance that they're going to be reinfected? Well, it's still pretty high. And that's kind of the alternate argument of this part is that, well, you know, but if they decrease their activity and they're not eating as much, they're going to be more exposed to more parasites. So that's kind of the alternate explanation. So yeah, but I mean, it is still very likely that they would be reinfected, unfortunately. And the main take-home point of all this is infected toads grew slower and had lower survival. And actually, three of the eight frogs that were infected with the 160 parasites ended up living. The other five died. But they actually looked like they were returning to normal by the end of the study. So even though they had a tremendously high amount of parasites, they were still recovering. And, you know, using their parasite-induced anorexia and kind of holding out seemed to be working. So, okay, this next one is a good old tapeworm everybody's heard about. Basically, it passes through cats and dogs through feces and then is ingested by, the freshwater crustaceans, which are eaten by amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. And then tadpoles serve as the vectors for this lovely parasite. And the primary hosts are cats and dogs. And this is a pretty rough little guy here. It migrates through the internal organs and actually burrows in the thigh muscle tissue, which has to be painful. And it excretes an immune suppressant and an anti-inflammatory agent so that the frog doesn't realize it's in there. So it can't send all of its defenses to take care of it. The thigh tissue is actually liquefied. Lymph sacs are damaged and holes appear in the skin, exposing the frog to bacteria, which can then lead to septicemia or blood poisoning. And the spirometra, as it's crawling through the internal organs and into the thigh muscle, it can actually create cavities in the thigh muscle, which may fill up with blood and kind of make it have sort of like jelly legs. Like it can't really jump anymore and evade predators. So it's kind of a bad way to die. Outward signs of spirometra include lesions, lumps, and fluid retention in the legs. So I guess their legs kind of swell up a little bit. Now we'll move on to protozoal parasites. The sporozoan Chargesium is known to cause clogging of the gills and spiracle in tadpoles. So I guess that's where they kind of migrate to. And it can result in developmental retardation and death. And then Apiosoma, this one's typically found in fish. Most, like 98% of the literature is on, you know, trout. They're in trout and a couple of darters and stuff like that. But amphibians, the Apiosoma will overcrowd and block the gut tube so they can't absorb nutrients. And it can also cause clogging of gills. And then Trypanosoma, which we've all heard of, actually affect amphibians as well. So it's a blood parasite transmitted by blood-sucking leeches. This one is pretty interesting. It's an endoparasitic mite. So it has a four-stage life cycle, egg, larvae, nymph, and adult, but only the larvae affect amphibians. And the larvae burrow into the skin's skin of the frog, and they form like little red pustules behind the eye. And you can see that in this right there. You would think it was just kind of a big wart, but it's not. It's full of lovely mites. And the effect on the frogs is unclear. Some think that it may kill them, or it may just serve as vectors for infectious diseases by breaking down the frog's defenses. And some ectoparasites. So what are some ectoparasites? I know you said leeches, Guy. So what would be something else that would affect the amphibian on the outside? What else would parasitize it that way?
Flies.
Yeah, flies. Anything else?
There are external mites as well.
Yeah, there are. I didn't include those since I had the endo parasitic ones. But yeah, there's also external mites. Let's see, I think there's also some arthropods that feed on them. Some other, I can't remember what it was. But yeah, there's several different ectoparasites. But the ones I've included are leeches, which are common on amphibians that live in or enter the water to breed. And they can cause anemia from blood loss. And kind of a secondary effect is that they can transmit protozoa, bacteria, and viruses. So even if they're not killing the amphibian themselves, they may be transmitting something that eventually will. And flies, they lay their eggs on the bodies of the anurans, and some of them burrow under the skin of the back, and the blowflies are pretty creepy. That's the ones I was talking about. They move towards the head and enter through the eyes or the nostril and kind of eat the frog from the inside out, which is kind of creepy and not very comfortable. And there's actually a leech on this spotted salamander, which I thought was pretty cool. So, and then this is the batrachyomia, and then this one is the blowfly larvae. So, and then this is the chytrid fungus paper that I found relating it to parasites. And they surveyed 13 ponds in and just outside of Redwood National Park in 2001 and 2002. And the first Rana aurora aurora, or the northern red-legged frog, tadpoles from each pond were collected and analyzed for the presence of chytrid fungus. And then also they basically took down every single parasite that they found. 86% of the tadpoles had at least one parasite, and 63% were infected by more than one species of parasite. And they found that frog species that were infected with chytrid fungus had significantly fewer parasite species than those not infected. So apparently the chytrid has some effect on the parasites and not letting them latch on or whatever. Tadpoles in deeper water were more susceptible to chytrid because the water was at a lower temperature. And apparently chytrid likes lower temperature waters because tadpoles in the shallower waters were less likely to have chytrid fungus and have more parasites in the study. So possible direct effects of chytrid on parasites include, which is what they're doing basically to keep the parasites from latching on, allopathic secretions preventing other parasites from colonizing, geez. Competition for space within buccal cavity, because if chytrid's there, he doesn't want anybody else there, basically. And then also the chytrid may predate on other parasites, so direct consumption. Future directions for research. Little is known about the distribution of Roboraria and what species are susceptible. There's been a few studies done on a couple of ranas and I think maybe a couple of hylas, but they don't really know what species are susceptible because a couple of them haven't really responded to it. So they don't know what mechanism is making some frogs susceptible and some not be. So that's something to find out. And also, they don't know exactly what the mechanism is that leads to malformations in Roboraria. They assume that it's because the, like I said earlier, because the parasite is colonizing around the limb buds, or maybe there's a chemical response, but it's not really not known. Also, more studies are needed that incorporate multiple stressors because sometimes, like we said earlier, you know, runoff, pesticides, stuff like that can decrease the amphibian's immune response and make them more susceptible to parasite infections. So something needs to be done to kind of combine all of that, even though it'd probably be pretty difficult, but be worth a shot. And specific studies are needed to examine host size and how it influences parasite-induced mortality. Because in a lot of the studies, the smaller guys were hit a whole lot harder than the older individuals. So that's all I have. Does anyone have any questions? That was really short, I'm sorry.
Could you go back to that last slide?
Yeah.
What are your
Sure, yeah, my required readings. Let me give you that. Let me get to the last slide, Megan.
No, I can look at it, it's fine. I'm looking at it.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, and the required readings that I gave you guys were the two studies that I focused on the most, with the Rabirorea, and then also, which is the trematode, and then the nematode Rabidius bufonis. Let's see here. Can't see anything. So basically, they're pretty short and to the point, but they sum up pretty much all of the evidence that I could find saying that they did have an effect on them. I don't know what else to say. I'm sorry. Yes, these are required readings, but I tried to pick ones that weren't too terribly long, so yeah. Yeah, I'm probably not even saying it right. So, yeah, we'll go for that.
I mean, are they sure that it's, because I haven't read these yet, they're sure right. that it's causing the malformation, that it couldn't possibly be, that it is actually it causing the malformation?
So, the question is the Rabirorea causing the infections? In this?
The malformations.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant. In this study, yes, and there's actually a couple different studies that have shown that this is specifically doing it, but it's species specific. So there's a couple studies of different species of frog where it doesn't necessarily affect them. And most of the frogs in all of these studies were found with some kind of parasite in them anyways, and a lot of them are living fine. So, I mean, there's still a lot of research to be done on, you know, what parasites can we live with in what species, and you know, why does it affect this species and not a sister species?
Or are there any correlations between some having certain parasites and it that causes the malformation?
Right.
I'm interested in knowing whether...
Right. I mean, that's what I was saying on the future directions for research, because there's so many different parasites. I mean, I didn't even include them all. There's just so many. But they can interact with each other. And then also, you know, other factors, like I was saying, runoff and stuff like that, you know, all of this, there's a bajillion different factors coming in, and you don't know, I mean, they think, because these frogs in the Rabirorea study were put into a pond, and they tested the water to make sure that there was no heavy metals or pesticides or anything like that. So they made sure that the water was controlled, and there was no predators in it, so they shouldn't be stressed that way because they had a mesh net over it. So in that study, it looked like, yes, that was definitely the cause. So...
Did you have any paper about the protozoa?
Protozoa?
Yeah.
I looked everywhere, actually, for papers on protozoal parasites, and I couldn't find anything, so those were actually things that were in the book. I couldn't.
So the book's got some good stuff on
it? It only has, like, 2 pages. So I was on Web of Science a lot looking for papers, and there was very few, and they were all really old. Like from the 70s and 50s. So there's not a lot of recent research on this topic. So there's definitely, it's wide open for that. So, any other questions?
What affects the parasite? The amphibian themselves, how they protect themselves from parasites.
How do they protect themselves from the parasites? Well, it doesn't seem like they can do a whole lot. I mean, you know, that one had, I think it was the tapeworm, had all the things so that the frog wouldn't know that it was attacking it. I didn't find anything out about any of the rest of them, but it doesn't seem like they really knew what was going on. And like I said, some of them can live fine with these parasites. So I'm not sure what they're doing to defend themselves, honestly. I don't know if there is anything they can do.
One defense, it seemed like, was the anorexic state.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that definitely, you know, taking down their feeding to kind of hold out for the parasite to work its way through seemed to be one of the responses, I guess.
How do the Sicaria infect the tadpoles?
In the Rabirorea? Basically, with those, the only thing, I'm sorry?
Did you read about that?
Just in the 2 papers that I found on Rabirorea. The only thing I found was that they got in the limb buds. and kind of interfered there, either mechanically or chemically. Was there more to it than that?
Yeah, I'm kind of, where do they basically, how do they burrow into the animal? Do they attack it from the side, or did you read about that?
I did, but I've read a lot about different ones. I can't remember if those were rectal. I don't think they were rectal. I think they went through the skin, it seems like. I'm sorry.
Well, there's, there's lots of Sicaria. It's just a spices, has Sicaria. Results in swimmer's itch,
right.
And they can just burrow into you.
Right.
Tadpoles are relatively mobile, and as far as attacking into the side of a tadpole, that's
not really possible.
At least from controlled research, that doesn't appear to be the way
okay.
they're affecting. There's a zone of kind of dead, stagnant water right behind the vent. A tadpole, and they
okay.
usually swim up into that zone
okay.
and often infect through the vent. Or in that region, at least.
Right. So parasites pretty much come in all directions. Anything else?
In the Gilder study, is that the one you're talking about with the toes?
In which, the Robertoria one? Oh, yeah, the nematode.
That was done. Is that done in enclosures?
Yes.
What was the experimental
design? I believe, let me fix this real fast, I'm sorry. I believe that one was also done in ponds. Let me check real fast.
Were they looking at the metamorphs or tadpoles?
They were looking at the tadpoles. They started out with, they got eggs from the field, I believe, and then kind of let them mature. Let me look real fast. Seems like that's what they did. Yeah, they were collected as tadpoles. Yeah.
And did they start the experiment? Were they adding the nematodes to the tadpoles, or once they
met I know that they put them. I know they put them in petri dishes that had the parasites on like a piece of some kind of special paper. Oh, moist filter paper, and that's how they were transmitted. I think they used them as, I don't know. I don't think they say. I guess they used them as tadpoles. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. What?
I was wondering if that parasite is something that simply attacks the adult metamorphs versus.
Oh. Ooh.
It's like, I was a little confused on not much about it.
Hang on, let me go back to my slides here. Yes, sure. There we go. I guess they were adults. And then the nematodes.
Yeah, they were metamorphs.
Yeah. So on that one, it didn't study the effect of the tadpoles. It just studied the effect of the adults. And their body weight, because it was saying, that's right, because it was saying about the small adults were more susceptible than the larger adults. Sorry.
Also, one of the things you're thinking about, well, if they just waited out, are they just getting reinfected?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing it in a laboratory situation, too. They don't have the opportunity to basically escape.
Right.
They
I think they cleaned out the pots every like so many weeks or something to kind of prevent that, I guess.
Okay.
So that'll bring it down a little bit, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, that makes
sense. I guess to kind of recreate natural habitat where they could actually get away from their own feces.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How long can they survive outside the host, the nematodes?
That's a fabulous question. I have absolutely no idea. I'm sorry. I wouldn't think very long. Especially on these, I really don't know a lot about their life cycle. I'm sorry.
Some of the ones that, like the echinostomes I've talked about, once they leave the intermediate host, the snail, mm-hmm. they don't last very long.
Yeah, I wouldn't think they would.
They have a few hours to find tadpole and infect tadpole.
Okay.
They die off. I don't know about this.
I would think it would be the same way. So. Anything else? Sorry. Okay. I almost made it.